everybody, and welcome to the Yale University Art Gallery. On behalf of the International Festival of Arts and Ideas, I'd like to welcome you here. I'm Elsie Chapman, and I'm Vice Chair of the Board of the International Festival of Arts and Ideas. And again, a welcome to this, our second weekend of the festival, and to this afternoon's first Ideas event, Africa, Ebola, and Global Health Equity. In all truth, the idea for this panel came actually from Angelique Kidjo. She'll be performing on the First Niagara stage tomorrow night at 7 and is this year's recipient of the festival's Visionary Leadership Award. Angelique is an active advocate for the rights of women and girls in Africa and is a vocal spokesperson against what has been negative Western media's coverage of the Ebola epidemic. This panel is in honor of her admirable work. This weekend, the festival programming also focuses on justice and fair representation in our own country. Shortly after this talk, at 3 p.m., right here, poet Claudia Rankine will speak about her acclaimed book, Citizen, which addresses the racism undergirding daily life in the U.S. Then, at 5 p.m., come be part of our first festival town hall at 1156 Chapel Street. That's the building right across the street from the study. For those of you who know where the study hotel is, it's the Eisman Theater right across the street from the hotel. And as a part of this community forum, you'll be able to participate in a forum about active citizenship, civility, and equality with your fellow community members, something not to be missed. All of our ideas, talks, and panels are generously sponsored by Connecticut Humanities and the Whitney Center, with additional support from the David P. Langrock Foundation. I'd also like to thank our generous partners, the Yale University Art Gallery and the Yale Center for British Art. This ideas event is also sponsored by Yale New Haven Health System and Yale New Haven Hospital, as our Healthy Living sponsor. It's a great pleasure to introduce our moderator, Greg Gonzalez, who brought together this all-star panel today and is himself an expert in health and justice. Greg is a research scholar in law and a lecturer in law at Yale Law School. He's the co-director of Yale's Global Health Justice Partnership and a leading HIV/AIDS activist, and he's worked with a number of major organizations on issues of global health equity. We're so grateful that he agreed to spearhead this event and has convened such an amazing group here today. Please give a warm welcome to Greg Gonzalez.
Welcome to our panel. If you're from New Haven, if you're from the U.S., you probably couldn't ignore what happened last fall in terms of the outbreak of the Ebola epidemic in Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia. But if you're like me and you're in New Haven, a lot of the stories you heard were about names like Craig Spencer and Casey Hickox and Amber Vincent and Thomas Eric Duncan. And you didn't hear about the stories that happened in Liberia and Sierra Leone and Guinea. And about the epidemic in the countries where it mattered most, where thousands of people got sick and died. And the genesis of this panel was from Andrew Kijo, as you heard, and Alex Gribb asked me to put this together. I've worked in Southern Africa for a long time on health and human rights, and I'm not an expert in Ebola or on Sierra Leone, Guinea, or Liberia. And when I thought about how to put this panel together, I said, who do you want to listen to learn more about these things? And I haven't had the ability to read the works of Ashoka, Chenoir, Badia, and Francisco, and thought, you know, they really put perspective on the epidemic that I don't think many people in New Haven, Connecticut, or the U.S. have really gotten a chance to hear. And the exercise today is to give you a chance to hear about what they've been thinking and what they've been writing, what they've been doing over the past year and a half around the Ebola epidemic and around global health and health equity. And so what we're going to do for the format of this panel is to let them each speak for 5-7 minutes or so to give you a sense of how they've sort of conceptualized and what they've thought and what they've been doing around the Ebola epidemic, to hear a little bit about where they're coming from, where they're, how their perspective has been sort of built to sort of craft the analyses that you're going to hear about. We'll go through the panel, let them do their 5 to 7 minutes. I'll ask a few questions. They can, if they'd like, interject and ask questions back and forth between each other. And then probably for the last half hour or so, we will open it up to the floor, and we'd ask you to go to these two mics. And we're ready to open it up to the floor for questions. And so I think we'll just go down the line here in the order, and I'll introduce people and give them a chance to talk. Our first speaker is Francisco Perez. He graduated from Harvard in 2006 with a BA in Social Studies and Women and Gender and Sexuality Studies. He's worked in Senegal for an NGO called TOSTAN, which is an international human rights and literacy NGO. He's also more recently worked as a program manager for Catholic Relief Services in Guinea when the Ebola epidemic hit there. He'll be going back to school to get a PhD in economics at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst in the fall. Without further ado, Francisco, give you a chance to sort of make
yes,
some opening.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much for coming. We're really glad to have you here. It's good to know that so many people are interested in such an important topic. I worked for 2 years, the last 2 years, as a business development program manager with Catholic Relief Services. I was based in Freetown in Sierra Leone, covered Guinea and Liberia. And I was there for about a year when Ebola first sort of hit. So I kind of got to see the crisis unfold, and then was subsequently had to be evacuated in August before going back in February of this year. So when I came home, I was sort of just reflecting, and I ended up writing my friend a long letter, trying to explain what happened. You know, how did this come to be? And she encouraged me to publish it, which I did. And you know, in looking through, you know, what, you know, we obviously kind of know what happened in the immediate sense. There was an outbreak, the disease spread, people were caught off guard, and it had terrible consequences in terms of loss of human life and on people's livelihoods and just the social fabric and overall in these three countries. But you know, I wanted to really look at what were the deeper issues, what was really going on here, what is the sort of deep background to that sets a sort of stage for something like this, and you know, identify kind of three major areas. Obviously, in reading, you know, the work of the other panelists, there's more to the topic. But I thought these three are specifically very important. You know, the first one being, you know, looking at why the public health system was so inadequate. You know, why was it that, you know, because Ebola is actually rather easy to contain. You know, you just need proper hygiene, proper control, and people were dying because they didn't have water and soap to wash their hands. They didn't have gloves. They didn't have caps and gowns and other sort of basic protective equipment. And you know, you ask why that is, and you go back to, you know, all these countries, Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea, have all had their, have basically been under tutelage by, you know, the IMF and the World Bank for decades now. And they're often the ones who control the purse strings, right? So they're the ones who decided who gets to spend how much money on healthcare. So if you look at a system where you don't have enough trained nurses, you don't have enough trained doctors and personnel, you start looking at, well, why is that? You know, you look at the sort of roles that these international organizations play in setting fiscal policy in these countries. They don't really have the policy autonomy, you know, necessary to build public health systems that are, you know, worthy of the name. You know, secondly, Ebola is a neglected tropical disease. You know, and once you're in places like Sierra Leone, you hear about other diseases that, you know, no one, you know, when it first came out, we all thought it was a case of Lassa fever, for example. Lassa fever is another sort of one of these diseases we don't hear about that tends to affect a lot of people. But you know, pharmaceutical companies ignore these diseases because there's not money to be made there, right? So one of the things that we learned when Ebola hit was we don't actually know that much about Ebola. You know, we didn't really know where it came from, how it spread. You know, we a lot of the initial information we received turned out to be wrong. You know, they told us that 90% of people had a 90% case fatality rate. You know, it was essentially a death sentence, and we have way more than 90% of people who survived. You know, and part of it, we just didn't have the research on the different strains of disease, how to contain it. And we've seen since the response how, you know, now that it, you know, became sort of made international headlines, now you see funds going toward vaccine development and vaccine trials. And, you know, now all of a sudden people are willing to invest in this disease. And, you know, it makes me wonder, you know, what will be the next sort of, you know, outbreak that will finally motivate us to focus on that disease. And then finally, the one sort of thing that I feel like people weren't talking a lot about, which I thought was crucial to just how this all unfolded, was the environmental impact of a lot of these development initiatives in these countries. You know, the fact is we are, because of mining and logging and corporate agriculture and these sort of big palm oil and sugarcane plantations, cutting deeper and deeper into what used to be sort of virgin forests. And in a lot of places, there are even, you know, cultural taboos against going into certain parts of the forest. And we've seen that whole sort of social and environmental ecological system kind of, you know, be seriously threatened. And this is, you know, how a lot of these diseases jump from animals to people, is by us coming into increasing contact with them. You know, so now that it's, you know, I got a chance to go back in February and see that, you know, it's not quite the dire situation I left behind in August, but it is, you know, that the outbreak is still not over, and I feel like we still have not addressed these sort of root causes, and whether it's Ebola or something else, we're likely to see, you know, another epidemic that's likely to, you know, to also cause needless suffering, unless we start looking at, you know, some of these bigger issues and thinking of how we can work with activists and just concerned citizens in these places to, you know, improve the situation in all three countries and throughout the region.
So, thanks, Francisco. Our next panelist is Adia Benton. Adia is an assistant professor of anthropology at Brown University, and her research and teaching focuses on ideologies, cultural practices, and the political economy of global health. She has a not-so-new book called HIV Exceptionalism, Development Disease, Through Disease in Sierra Leone, which you should all read, and it's an ethnographic account of how HIV exceptionalism, the idea that AIDS is an exceptional disease requiring exceptional responses, had sort of untoward effects and unforeseen consequences. Adia's written quite a lot about the Ebola epidemic as it was unfolding in West Africa, and, Adia.
Thank you. So, as Greg mentioned, I've worked in Sierra Leone, and that was actually quite a long time ago now that I'm thinking about it. But my focus has long been, since 2000, on public health and health systems. And my interest as an anthropologist, it's not exactly an anthropological thing, right? When you hear anthropology, you think of people who understand exotic cultural practices of local people. In fact, I'm interested in those things, but my localities happen to be the tribes of global health and of non-governmental organizations. How do we understand the cultures of institutions, and how do we embed those in, or how do we understand the histories that produce the kinds of relationships that NGOs engender, foster, and reproduce? My experience has been one, during this Ebola epidemic, I've had to rethink how we talk about institutions. Do we talk about them in light of broader historical patterns like the enslavement of people from this region, like the Mono River region, right? How do those histories impact how we interpret resource extraction, corporate agriculture, and mining practices? Many of you know that Liberia has Firestone, which is a rubber plantation that has a long history of collusion with oppressive, radical now. I'm like, oppression and all, I use the word oppression twice. So, and we can talk about this more, but how do we understand what's happening within a broader historical context? How do we understand the cultures of institutions, the practices in which they engage, and how these have shaped health systems, how they've shaped humanitarian assistance, right? So who comes to help and who gets flown out when Ebola gets too hard, right? This is a question that I've asked in my writing. Francisco, you left, right?
Yes.
You were evacuated because we were worried that you were going to get sick, or, you know, things like that. So what this revealed for me as a person who studies institutional cultures was how lives matter in the practice of humanitarian assistance, but also how these things shaped health systems to begin with. As Francisco mentioned, IMF and World Bank have had a great impact on budgets. But a civil war also did, right? Civil war made it possible for people to think of Sierra Leone and Liberia and Guinea to some extent as blank slates. Those blank slates, you know, those are fictions. There was social life before, during, and after war. But when you think of a place as being a blank slate, how do systems get built up? Who dictates the shape, the cultures, the expansiveness of those institutions, the effectiveness of those institutions. So we have to talk about who funds medical schools, who funds public health schools. If you look at the numbers of doctors in Liberia and Sierra Leone, you will learn that there were very few clinicians working. Guinean physicians were trained by Cubans, Cubans were also working in all of these places. So how do we understand the political economy of clinical care? I'll leave it there because I think we'll have more questions.
So our next speaker is Junior Ba, and he's an advocate for global education and a champion for girls. And he's now at the Population Council, where he leads their work on post-emergency programs for adolescent girls in Sierra Leone. Before joining the POP Council, he was a youth engagement coordinator at a World for School, a global campaign that ensures that all children have the opportunity to thrive and learn, which he co-founded in 2013. At the age of 15, following years of civil war in Sierra Leone, Chandra founded and led the Children's Forums Network.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here. Great to see all of you here. I was just going to say how hard it is to follow that. That sounded very deep compared to the stories that I'm about to tell you. So, as Greg said in the introduction, I was busy minding my business here in the United States, working in New York on global education. What I'm passionate about is to get every kid everywhere into school and learning. I work with the United Nations system. I co-founded a global organization, working with young people around the world. I was involved in the advocacy area immediately after Malala was shot, and I've been very, very involved in everything leading up to her winning the Nobel Peace Prize, including introducing her when she gave her big speech at the UN. But I'm from Sierra Leone, and I was born and raised there. I was a refugee in Guinea for a while, and then I worked in Liberia after the war there, helping to do youth programs for the UN. So I know the three countries pretty well. And the first thing I will say is, in many ways, and it builds on the two points that you've just made, the reason why Ebola got to where it got was because it found a perfect host. Here was a set of countries, you know, the theory about the blank slates, the fact that there was no or barely any structures that existed. The human capacity itself in these countries was very limited. The three countries combined account for the lowest illiteracy rates in the world, adult illiteracy rates in the world. And, you know, because of the war, because of everything that had happened, we were just beginning to build structures and institutions when Ebola hit. So how did I get involved? I was here and studied hearing all of these stories, and in September, and I thought to myself, well, I'm a humanitarian, I've worked in emergencies, and I want to go back and see, particularly, one of my passions is around girls' education, how this was affecting girls. Because I was hearing in the immediate aftermath, the response is very few people were talking about the human effect of this. Not only the people who were getting infected, but the people who were getting affected by all of this. Those people that were not being evacuated, but whole towns and districts were being shut down. They quarantined whole communities, for example, and neighborhoods. And so I raised some money here in the US, and I went out to do some distribution, but also to help tell the story. And I went to Port Loko, which is still the most affected district in the country. My father lived in Kenema, and I went out there. And one of the things that really shocked me in my experience, and I've been four times now, I just came back again in April, and I've switched my job from focusing on global education to really trying to focus on dealing with the aftermath of the Ebola response, because as most of you will know, the cameras have left. Well, just yesterday, Sierra Leone had three cases, but you don't hear that anymore in the news. We still have a number of people who are still in hospitals and still affecting us. But one of the things that shocked me was just the fact that the lack of any coordinated response to what was going on. It was so haphazard. It was the government didn't know what to do. The president took so long to declare it. an emergency, WHO. You know, the UN system is fantastic, and I work within the system, so I love it. They created the Ebola response in Ghana. The headquarters for the UN structure that was created, they placed that in Accra, Ghana, and it was supposed to coordinate everything that was happening in the country. And the president appointed a new coordinator of Ebola and then kept the Ministry of Health separate. So you had the UN response, you had the Ministry of Health, you had WHO, you had everything else going, and it was a complete chaos. So that first of all, kind of took me aback, and I think it goes back to the fact that there was no the human element of it. Girls, the education. I looked at the UN response, everything that they had called for, and the word education barely even featured. And here we were already close to a whole academic year where nobody had gone to school. And I work in education. I know when kids stay out of school for a year, it's two times less likely that they're not going to come back to school. And particularly for girls, I know that, because I talk about this a lot, because of the quarantines, because people were home, nobody was moving, actually sexual activity went up. And some people are surprised by this. It didn't go down because people are not going to stop having sex. Actually, they're going to have more. And reproductive health services in the country, which the baseline before Ebola was about 10% access to modern contraceptives. I talked to Mary Stopes, and they were, in some cases, down by 90%, in some cases, down by 100%. So you had a baseline of 10%, now down by 90%. So you had what was, in essence, the beginning of an even major epidemic that we're not even talking about. I worked with, and I helped found a group, a coalition in Sierra Leone of NGOs who were working on adolescent girls' issues. Some of them were providing support for victims of fistula. And the government said, if you have a program that was not responding directly to Ebola, you have to close it. So girls and young women who had fistula were sent back home to their communities. And there was no support initially. So in the complete chaos, in the complete kind of a little bit mirror some of the reaction that you had here in the US as well, right? People were thinking with their hearts and not with their head anymore, and with fear and less with reason. And then, for me, as I said, the other thing was just what was happening to young girls who were in these households. Pregnancy had gone up. We did a little bit of quick study in some towns, and we saw that, I talked to young girls, and most of them would tell me what they're most afraid of was, their uncles. For those of you who have been to Sierra Leone, we live in crowded households, particularly the poor people, right? So when nothing happens, economic activity is not happening, nothing is happening, what happens is you then have basically predatory hotspots, right? Because everybody's home and all the people who are supposed to take advantage of you are out there, and you have nothing that they're doing. So all of these things contributed, and these are the things that this country has to deal with now going forward. The fact that schools have reopened, but the 3,000 girls that were pregnant, well, this is, again, a very conservative number, have been told if you're pregnant, you cannot go back to school. That's one fight we're having now in the country. Because if you're pregnant, it's somehow your fault. Despite everything I've just said, it's the girl's fault. And secondly, as I've said, the education infrastructure in the country, teachers left. My mom is a teacher. She left, and she's back now in Sierra Leone. But a good number of them will never return to the country. So what I wanted to give voice to was that beyond the anger, the fear, beyond the immediacy of somebody's going to die of Ebola, what really they showed, and back to the point where I said it found a perfect host, was there was a lack of human capacity. There was a lack of the kind of investment in education and in health systems. And the response has mirrored that. And unfortunately, it's going to leave these countries worse off than where we are. And as I said, it's the real image of that is that I bet a good number of you didn't know that last week in Sierra Leone we had 11 cases of Ebola, and that people are still dying, but it's no longer in the news, and the attention span has left. But it's what we're going to continue to do.
Thanks, General. The last panel speakers I showed them were both. It's interesting. Everybody's bios I took from their websites, and Shoka's is the shortest and the most. You'll hear. Ashok is a writer and advocate who spent 2 years working with the Liberian advocacy group that organizes communities to demand fair treatment
by foreign investors. He had a little run-in with Ebola virus last fall and lived to tell about it.
Well, thanks, Greg. I think the first thing to understand is that we can't see the Ebola outbreak as only a health crisis. In a lot of ways, it was actually a crisis of state-citizen relations. So one of the things that I think surprised people so much was this Ebola denial that happened. So you saw people in West Africa who felt like this is a hoax, and who do we trust? We're not going to adopt the preventative measures that can keep us safe. And a lot of people in the West didn't understand why this was happening. We felt like, there was this idea of, well, is it lack of education or superstition or a lot of these stereotypes about Africa? But actually, if you know these countries pretty well, you'd understand that their relationship with their government has typically not been very good. So, if you look at Liberian history, there's a lot of exploitation. There's exploitation by systems of government. There's exploitation by the international community, colonial extractivism, which Adia mentioned a little bit, and big power politics, Cold War, those kind of things. So the global economy that Liberia is a part of, it works really well for some people, mainly the elites in Monrovia. But for most of the rest of the people, it's not working. People feel like government structures aren't responsive to them. They're essentially ignored by investors. And this, I think, really fueled the Ebola crisis. So for us only to look at it in health terms, I think we're going to miss some of the actual social dynamics and political dynamics that made it worse. On paper, the government is doing everything the West wants. In some sense, Liberia is kind of a test case of what we might call neoliberal development philosophies. They emphasize investments. They facilitate a good business climate, and there's a lot of money that's put into things like policing. From a ground-up perspective, what people actually see is corruption. They feel like they can't access justice. There's a lot of police harassment. Services are bad. And unless you have money, you can't get a fair shake in trial and those kind of things. So, I think that the crisis didn't have to be as bad as it was. If people had been more responsive to the government and more responsive to warnings, it's likely that the outbreak would have actually ended pretty quickly. So what are the lessons of that, and how does international aid figure into it? I think with my experience working in Liberia, you see that the aid community tends to work from a government perspective. They support the government, they give them money, they listen to what they have to say and what people themselves actually feel about how the development of their society is happening. It's not that important to them. And, that kind of philosophy, I think, dominates what we might call peace building and peacekeeping. And it's not working. I think that it took the Ebola crisis for anybody who really is an observer of these countries to see just how mistrusted the government is. But moving forward, if you want to, maintain peace and you want to ensure that Liberians, and I can't speak to Sierra Leone again, I'm not actually super familiar with those places, but in Liberia particularly, if you want to support a country that people feel like they're a part of and that they feel proud to be in, you need to start listening to them better. I think that the aid community has responsibility in this because their support, financial and political, for the government has sort of allowed the government to marginalize and not listen to the voices of people themselves. And I think now there's a bit of a push to just go back to the status quo. So, okay, Ebola's done, in Liberia at least. I know there's still problems in other places, but people feel like, okay, now that we got this out of the way, let's just go back to the way things were. And I think that would be a pretty significant mistake. So we have to really look at the politics of the situation and start to listen to people and see how the state-building process can be done better.
Thank you, Shoka. So I have a few questions, and then if you guys want to jump in questions. So one of the things coming up here, and you've also touched upon it, is sort of how the political and economic policies sort of paved the path for Ebola to sort of break out in these three countries, and somehow the neoliberal policies had a part to play in this. There have been people like Chris Blackman at Columbia, who used to teach here at Yale, political science board would push back on that and said, this is research at a distance. And that, it's very nice for progressive lefties to think that, the IMF and the World Bank are at the root of all evil, but you know, you don't have the evidence to show that that's true. Would any of you like to sort of take on Chris?
I always like to take on Chris. as you might know. I wonder if it also, so there was actually quite a lot of back and forth with Chris Blattman on this. In fact, Kim Yi, Dion, and I wrote a response, because I think what he always asked for evidence, but I think he also has very little evidence to prove that it doesn't have an impact. What we do know is that World Bank and IMF are not simply about setting economic policy or controlling purse strings, so to speak, but they're also responsible for promoting a certain kind of ideology, right? A particular stance towards how to finance state-sponsored services, right? So even if they're not explicitly, you know, holding a gun to someone's head or whatever and saying you can't spend this much on health or education, which they kind of actually do, they have promoted, as Shoga mentioned, as Trina and Stoa also mentioned, they do promote a neoliberal ideology, which is focused on cutting spending for social services, improving especially in a post-conflict setting, improving sort of militarization and policing to a certain extent, and privatizing those things, privatizing social services in the forms of NGO, in the NGO. Right? So there are many ways in which these ideologies suffuse political and social practices. Yes, of course, IMF and the World Bank are not saying you must do this. Again, they are. but they also have espoused a certain way of thinking about the world, ordering the world, and what constitutes ethical practice from an economic political perspective. And I think that's the problem that
Blattman doesn't address. I could just kind of add to that, just as a little anecdote. When I first got to Liberia, I was doing a consultancy with the UN mission there, UNMIL, and our job was to look at foreign investors and how they were treating rural communities, you know, what their conflict dynamics around oil palm and mining and those kind of things were. So we spent 3 months studying this, and then we went to the special representative of the Secretary General, who's the chief of the UN mission, and had our findings. And we presented them to her and said, look, the government is, you know, doing things poorly. There's a lot of conflicts here, and people are being mistreated. And her response to this was, you know, that's great, you guys did a good job, but we would appreciate it that since we finance this research, that you don't put the report out until the elections are over. So that kind of thing is, you know, it might not be a direct, we're telling people what to do, but as long as, you know, policies that are seen as appropriate are being carried out by the government, then they get support. They, you know, people will try not to release negative information about them and those kind of things. So I don't think it's quite as simple as just the IMF tells you what to do. There's a whole structure out there that's set up to support certain kinds of state behavior, certain governance practices, and if you step out of line with that, there are consequences. And they might not be as straightforward as a loan getting pulled, but you'll feel them nonetheless.
So I want to take it from the political down to the personal a little bit, and I want to ask the two of you sort of related questions. One is for you, Ashoka, tell a word about Shaki Kumar, and talk a little bit about him.
Sure.
And then I'll go. Okay.
So Shaki Kumar was a 15-year-old boy who lived in a neighborhood in Monrovia called West Point. And West Point has a long history that you could do a whole panel on. It's a, you know, it's a really kind of important role in Monrovian society and Liberian culture. And West Pointers are among probably the most mistreated of Liberians. They're considered to be criminals. It's sort of like, that's the element. They're the poor people. You know, they're just a hassle. So when that Ebola denial first started happening in West Point, the government's response to it was very militarized, like Eddie was saying. They sent troops in. They quarantined. There was a break-in at a holding center. You know, people didn't think it was real, so they released a bunch of Ebola patients. And the government's response to that is, let's send the military in. And, of course, you know, you wake up, and life is already hard enough for you as it is. You have to find a way to go make money on a daily basis. You're